How do we respond when life doesn't seem to make any sense? What do we do when things don't go the way we think they should? Let me tell you the story of my friends Chris and Abby. A little over 2 years ago, when I started college, I met Chris in the very first week of college. He's a student with me at Oak Hill. And we were chatting over coffee one morning and just making conversation. And I casually asked Chris if he had any children. We'd already covered the fact that he was married, and I asked if he had any children. And Chris paused. He took a deep breath. And he said, "Well, yes and no. You're the first person who's asked me this at college, and I knew it would come, and I knew it would be hard. My wife, Abby, and I were on holiday in America this summer. Abby was about 20 weeks pregnant. She slipped and fell and went into early labor. Our son, Nathaniel, was delivered, but did not survive. All of a sudden, a casual coffee has got a little bit more serious. How do we respond when life doesn't seem to make any sense? But let me tell you some more of Chris and Abby's story, because we became quite good friends with Chris and Abby, and we were delighted with them when a few weeks, a month or two later, Abby was pregnant again with a new little baby, and it was wonderful, and it was very exciting. But then, at about 19 weeks, I think it was this time, Abby had complications and went into hospital. And doctors told them to prepare themselves for the worst. Now, Abby spent several months in hospital on permanent bed rest. And against all the odds, a little baby girl, Tilly, was born at full term. Something which the doctors had really thought was pretty much impossible. And it was wonderful. It was so joyous after months of suffering and struggling and everything that had happened with baby Nathaniel. To see and meet little baby Tilly and give her a cuddle was wonderful and awesome. And it's these lows and these highs and these lows and these highs. Well, let me tell you the next bit of the story. In fact, I'm just going to quote Chris and let him take the story up. At 6 weeks old, we started noticing some odd episodes where Tilly would stiffen and whip her head to the side. Not happy with the midwives and health visitors insisting it was wind, we took her to a neurologist who, after ordering a scan of electrical activity in Tilly's brain, confirmed it was epilepsy and referred her to Great Ormond Street Hospital. We turned up on a Friday morning to the GOSH Neuro Assessment Unit, thinking we'd be there for the day. In fact, this was the beginning of our first month and a half living at Great Ormond Street. The consultant told us that she had a catastrophic epilepsy, and we should prepare ourselves for a very frightening outlook. Cutting a long story short, after many months living in hospital and countless A&E trips in the middle of the night, at her first birthday, we know the following. Tilly has a complex and severe form of epilepsy with complex migrating partial seizures. This means she has permanently high levels of electronic activity in her brain, which both interrupts her ability to interact with the outside world and also flares up in seizures. She is treated via a cocktail of anticonvulsant drugs and also, because the drugs aren't really doing much, the ketogenic diet, which is a high-fat diet that has proven successful in managing seizures in children. What do we do when life doesn't go to plan? How do we respond when life doesn't seem to make sense? Chris and Abby are an exceptional story and an exceptional couple. But really, their story is all of our stories magnified up an awful lot. Because for all of us, life doesn't make sense sometimes. and life does not go according to plan. And how do we respond when these things happen? Do we break down and weep and allow them to crush us? Do we respond all stoically? Que sera, sera, whatever will be, will be. I hope this morning that the story of Ruth, this wonderful Old Testament book, can give us some shape for how we respond to the twists and turns of life. So let's recap what we've seen over the last couple of weeks, what we've seen from Matt and John in the last two Sundays. The story begins with the story of Elimelech and Naomi, a couple. They have two sons. But famine hits Bethlehem, where they live, and they flee to the nearby country of Moab in search of food and life. Tragedy. But while they were there, their two sons marry. They marry Moabite women, Orpah and Ruth. And you have this happiness of marriage and a future. But it continues on. Now Elimelech, verse 3 of chapter 1. Now Elimelech, Naomi's husband, died, and she was left with her two sons. They married, verse 5. After they had lived about 10 years, both Mahlon and Chilion, her sons, also died. And Naomi was left without her two sons and her husband. The day that you bury your husband is a dark day. The day that you bury your only two sons is darker still. But we have hope. The famine passes, and they return to the land of Bethlehem. And Ruth and Orpah go with Naomi. But ultimately, at Naomi's insistence, Orpah goes back to her own people and to her own gods. But Ruth clings to Naomi. And verse 1, of verse 16 of chapter 1, Ruth replies, "Don't urge me to leave you or turn back from you. Where you go, I will go, and where you stay, I will stay. Your people will be my people, and your God, my God. Where you die, I will die, and there I will be buried. May the Lord deal with me, be it ever so severely, if anything but death separates you and me." It's that hope of kinship and of love, that strength of relationship, as the two of them head back to Bethlehem, where Naomi is from. Naomi is pretty desolate. She tells the people there to call her not Naomi, but Mara. It means, don't call me pleasant, call me bitter. She is sad, she is depressed. But last week in chapter 2, we had glimpses of hope, the kindness of a stranger. This man Boaz, in whose fields Ruth was sent to glean. Now, gleaning was provided for in the Old Testament law. It was a form of localized social security, whereby when harvesting, landowners would not collect absolutely everything, but would leave bits of grain for the poor and the destitute to collect. And Ruth has collected this grain and found great kindness in this man Boaz, who has cared for her and given her food and protected her. This is a generous man, and this is yet another high point in the roller coaster of Ruth. Verse 23, where we finished last week, chapter 2, verse 23. So Ruth stayed close to the servant girls of Boaz to glean until the barley and wheat harvests were finished. And she lived with her mother-in-law. In the roller coaster of Ruth, we're back up onto a high again. They have food, they have some security, and they're back at home in the land. But this isn't enough for Naomi. She's no longer bitter. She has been given hope by this generosity. And she's starting to plot and scheme for her daughter-in-law. So chapter 3, verse 1. One day, Naomi, her mother-in-law, said to her, "My daughter, should I not try to find a home for you where you'll be well provided for?" Is not Boaz, with whose servant girls you have been, a kinsman of ours? She's plotting, she's planning. And the truth is that Ruth needs a redeemer. Ruth needs a redeemer. I don't know how many of you here have watched the Channel 4 series Downton Abbey. Rebecca and I got quite into it. But if you're familiar with it at all, you'll know that the first couple of series are taken up with the idea of heirs and the importance of establishing an heir for Lord Grantham. Firstly, in the form of his son-in-law, Matthew, who will inherit the state, and then with George, his grandson, who will inherit the state after him. But in here, when it's talking about redeeming, it's focusing on the need for an heir. So in the Old Testament, there are some funny laws that need explaining for us to understand this passage. If a man married, but he died before leaving an heir, then there were laws for what to do in that situation. And the law was this: a close relative, a close male, unmarried relative, would have to marry the widow. He would have to buy the land that had belonged to the man. And the first son that they had would inherit the land from the dead man and inherit the dead man's name. And so then the second son would be the actual heir of the of his father's estate. So a close relative would have to buy the land and marry the widow, and the firstborn son would inherit the dead man's estate. The secondborn son would inherit the live man's estate. And so this is what Naomi is talking about when he says he is a kinsman, and we get later on, he is a kinsman redeemer. It's this idea that he is the close relative who should marry Ruth so that the firstborn son can continue the line of that family. But the thing is, Naomi's plan is completely crazy. It really is. Did you pick up on that? Just imagine yourself in ancient times, suggesting that your daughter-in-law should go and hide where this man is working until he's fallen asleep, and then go and uncover his feet and lie at his feet until he wakes up. The risk for being misconstrued is massive. What if Boaz wakes up and in the darkness assumes she's some common prostitute touting for business and packs her on her way? What if Boaz wakes up and assumes she's some common prostitute touting for business and isn't quite as noble? What if somebody else sees them there? It's just highly inappropriate. But Ruth needs a redeemer. And this is Naomi's plan for getting one. And so Ruth carries it out. She goes, she dresses up, she goes to where he is working, and once he has lain down and gone to sleep, she goes up, she uncovers his feet, she lies down at his feet. And chapter 3, verse 8, in the middle of the night, something startled the man, and he turned and discovered a woman lying at his feet. "Who are you?" he asked. "I am your servant Ruth," she said. "Spread the corner of your garment over me, since you are a kinsman redeemer." This is not Ruth asking for a cuddle because she's a little bit chilly. This is Ruth effectively proposing marriage to Boaz. And this is completely topsy-turvy. Even in our society, we still expect generally that it should be the man who proposes to the woman. That was so much more definite then. But this is the woman proposing to the man. This is the younger proposing to the older, equally shocking in that society. This is the person who has been begging in the fields proposing to the owner of the fields. Also shocking. And this is a foreign woman proposing to an honourable native man. This is shocking. But Boaz is upright. Boaz is godly. Boaz understands what is going on, and Boaz agrees. And just as we think this is wonderful, this is it, this is the Redeemer that Ruth needs, this is the great, this is the high point, we've got another twist. An unexpected direction. A yes, but. There's a complication. Although it is true that I am near of kin, verse 12, there is a kinsman redeemer nearer than I. It was the closest relative who was to redeem the widow. And that is not Boaz. And everything about us wants Ruth to marry Boaz. I think that's what's going on with the whole six measures of barley thing we saw at the end. This is a godly, upright, generous man who wants to provide for Ruth and Naomi. He's the good guy. He's the guy you want the girl to marry. But there's a complication. There's a twist. There's a turn. We'll see next week how it's resolved. But in the meantime, why this twist? Why this twist? Why can't Ruth just get on and marry Boaz now? Why do we have to throw another spanner into the works? And I think another spanner into the works meets us where we're at. The complications and the difficulties of life for Ruth ring true for us too. Life does not run smooth. It does not run how we would want it to go. Don't know if you're familiar with the play Waiting for Godot. It's a fascinating play where the whole play exists with two men waiting for this character, Godot, who never actually shows up. He is a character who is the focus of the whole play, but who is not actually there. He is spoken of much, but not seen. And the same is true with the Book of Ruth. I wonder if you've noticed that there is somebody missing from the Book of Ruth. Given that this is a biblical book, there is somebody quite significant missing. It's God. Like Godot, he is spoken of much, but appears little. We see no obvious actions of God. We hear no speeches of God in the Book of Ruth. There are no miracles. There are no oracles. But unlike in the play of Godot, where Godot is a foil for the other characters to spar off, I think in this book we see God much more centrally. Whilst God does not act miraculously, the point of the book is that God is behind everything. Every twist and turn, every action and speech, God is at work in shaping the story and in bringing it to be. The word that is often used to describe this is the providence of God. Ruth needs a redeemer, and God is providentially providing one. Every action and speech that the characters are responsible for, God is also responsible for. Things that happen in this book do not happen outside of God's will. They happen because God is sovereign and is controlling it all. God is sovereign over a famine which sends these people off to a foreign country. He is sovereign over their marriages and over bringing Ruth and Naomi back. He is sovereign over cleaning in the fields and over the poverty. It is God's providence at work. Ruth needs a redeemer, and God is providentially providing one. So why all the twists and turns? God is at work. Ruth needs a redeemer. God is providentially providing one, but we're not there yet. We've hit this another bump in the road with this nearer kinsman redeemer. And this hits true for us. God's normal mode of acting is not through the miracles and the dramatic. Sometimes he does, but they are by nature suspensions of the regular laws. But God is working through every twist and turn, and that is true for us too. And if you are at a twist in the road today, then know that God's purposes cannot be thwarted. He is working in this world and in our lives for good. And so the setbacks that we have seen in the book of Ruth are God's tools in shaping and changing people and bringing about his purposes. Ruth has been transformed from an ignorant worshipper of foreign idols to a godly, upright woman who has thrown her lot in with Yahweh, the God of Israel, and is following him. Naomi has been transformed from this bitter, poor woman to a woman who is working for the good of her daughter-in-law. And we see the kindness and the generosity of Boaz, not through the good times, but through the twists in the story. There are no what-ifs in life. There are no accidents. There is no blind chance that this is just the way it is. God is working in our lives as he worked in the lives here. The book of the story of Ruth is also the story for every Christian. I think we much more easily see the difficulties in life than we see God's providence at work. Let me read you a quote. This is how the pastor John Piper summarizes the book of Ruth. Life is a winding and troubled road. Switchback after switchback. And the point of biblical stories is to help us feel in our bones, not just know in our heads, that God is for us in all these strange turns. The life of the godly is not a straight line to glory. It is more like a dark and seemingly unknown trail through the mountains. There are rock slides and slippery curves and hairpin turns that make you go backwards in order to go forwards. But along this hazardous, twisted road that doesn't let you see very far ahead and may even make you feel like you've been led to the edge of a cliff, God gives us encouragement and hope that all the perplexing turns in our lives are going somewhere good. Often, when we think that God is farthest from us, or is even turned against us, the truth is that he is laying the foundation for greater happiness in our lives. God is plotting for our joy. He is plotting the course and managing the troubles with far-reaching purposes for our good and for the glory of Jesus Christ. What about my friend Chris and their little baby Tilly? I said they're an exceptional couple. They really are. Let me continue on later on in that letter that I read to you from earlier, what Chris has to say. Several people who have asked about our Tilly don't seem to have the categories in their thinking to process bad news, and have responded to a description of her condition with a nervous, Oh, I'm sure that it's something children grow out of. If your perspective is limited to the horizons of this world, then your only hope is that circumstances in this world will improve. We know that, short of a miracle, Tilly's future, even in the best light, is going to be difficult and frightening. But we have learned a valuable thing: to have our eyes lifted to the life to come, to the hope of the gospel, to the reality of the triune God. We have learned that the most important thing to learn is that God is God and we are not. We would not have chosen things this way. But then again, we would not have chosen the cross, a place of divine judgment against sin, as the means to save humanity and put things right. God has a wisdom that is perfect, that is perfectly loving. And we have learned to finally rest in that knowledge. Which takes me, as we close, to Christmas. And to how the book of Ruth relates to this season. In the book of Ruth, we've seen so far the divine providence working out this redeemer that Ruth needs. But ultimately, we'll see next week with Christine how this redeemer is one in a great line. That this redeemer is an ancestor of King David. And this redeemer is an ancestor of the baby born in a manger 2,000 years ago. God's providence at work to provide a redeemer for Ruth is the same providence that is at work to provide a baby in the manger and to provide a savior for us all. Just as Ruth needs a redeemer and God is providentially providing one in this story, we need a redeemer. Not to have our land and heirs secure. But Jesus himself said in Mark chapter 10 verse 45 that even the Son of Man did not come to be served but to serve and to give his life as a ransom for many. This is what Christmas is all about. Christmas is God providentially providing the Redeemer that we need to save us from our sins. And that is the glorious news of Christmas.